Hey yo, we about to tear it up. Yo,
break for break, break for break it down.
This right here is how we do it. Break it down.
It's the Breaking Atoms podcast, where we break things down to the very last compound. My name is still my name, and my name is Chris Mitchell, aka The Actual Factual. When Sumit and I first started this podcast, we had a bucket list of people that we wanted to get on the show. And this week's guest is high on the list because Sumit and I are massive fans of his music. I believe that this man is a living case study in longevity. He's pinned Father Time's shoulders to the canvas, made Whackness tap out, and his flow stays submerged in the fountain of youth. After setting off the symphony, he told us to take a look around the slaughterhouse where we would see him sitting on chrome. He then reminded us of the value of the culture on disposable arts after a long hot summer of classic songs. He plays well with others and has multiple group projects with EMC and Edo G, and he was incorporated way before Irv Gotti and Co. You can trace his influence in the work of Eminem and Kendrick Lamar, and in my opinion, he is the master, pun intended, of the concept album. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, dogs, cats, people with hard copies of De La Soul's albums and people without hard copies of De La Soul's albums, this is Master Ace, finally, on the Breaking Atoms podcast. Check it out.
What's going on, man? Thanks for having me on. I play well with others, huh?
Yeah, you do. I mean, look, EMC, A&E, Master Ace Incorporated, Marco Polo, you share the love.
Yeah, I like the term. It's funny.
It's all good. First of all, it's been an interesting 18 months. How you doing health-wise? How's the trendsetter bike group?
Yeah, it's great. It's been really, you know, it's been my saving grace in terms of being active. I was so used to my routine, which was in the gym 3 to 4 days a week, you know, taking these intense hit classes and sweating. And I was on a schedule, you know. And then when this pandemic hit and the gym closed, I was struggling to try to figure out. I mean, I did some home workouts and stuff like that, but I wasn't getting the same level of a workout that I was used to. And so at some point I just had to figure out something else to do to try to be active, and bike riding became that outlet.
We've had to say rest in peace to a few people. And most recently we said goodbye to Biz Markie, someone who you've known since the 80s, you've collaborated with. If an alien came from space and came to you and said, who was Biz Markie in your opinion, how would you eulogize him?
I would tell him that he was an incredibly creative individual, who had the ability to be himself without apology. He always was his true, authentic self around whoever he was around. And that was somebody who liked to joke, liked to crack jokes, make people laugh. But people don't give him enough credit for his creativity. He has so much, some of the records that he did, nobody would ever dare to do. You know, a song like Picking Boogers, nobody would ever think to do such a song, but he had the courage to do that. He wasn't caught up in the bravado that hip hop, you know, usually flexed. It was just about having a good time for him. And he loved the fact that nobody else was like him. He loved the fact that he was unique in that way. And, also a consummate performer. If you've ever seen him in his younger years, you know, before he gained weight, when he used to perform you mentioned the late 80s, early 90s, Biz was probably one of the best performers that you could see at that time. Most artists didn't want to follow him because he had so much fun with the crowd and the crowd had so much fun with him. So, you know, Not enough people talk about his ability to perform. So that's who he was. And he was a Juice Crew brother of mine who was always gracious to me and always showed love. And we're going to miss him for sure.
No, for sure. And you know, I'd like to offer my condolences to the family and friends of Biz Markie. Sticking with the Juice Crew, I read in an interview that just before the symphony came out, you were toying with the idea of changing your name. And then it came up on the screen, Master Ace, M-A-S-T-E-R. So you stuck with it.
Yeah, I didn't have... I wanted to do something different name-wise, but I didn't have I didn't have any other alternatives at the time. So it's not like, oh, I want to change my name to this. It was just a thought. Like, man, that Master thing is really... It's kind of old school, you know? And, you know... That name came from an era when everybody was Grandmaster this, Master that, Grandmaster this. And I could feel that we were moving into a new era in terms of the types of names the artists were having. And so I said to myself, like, man, it would be cool if I had a different name, if I could do something different with it. But once that video dropped and I didn't have an alternative name, I was stuck with that name. And that's what it was.
Okay, but I think, you know, it still sounds fresh in 2021. It's you, because you are, in my opinion, and we'll get into it, you are the master of the concept album.
I appreciate it, man. I had to drop that ER. I had to drop the ER off the Master, though, because it just looked too old school for me.
I know you're working on a musical, and correct me if I'm wrong, you've spent much of the pandemic working and writing this musical.
Yeah.
What are the differences in terms of writing a musical compared to a concept album? Are there any?
Huge differences. Huge. Because when I'm writing my music, there's really no rules. If I write a song for my album, I can really go anywhere I want with the lyrics. But in a musical, the songs have to be an extension of the story that you're telling. So you can't have lines in there that are just throwaway lines. Every line has to push the story forward. And that's really challenging for somebody who's used to kind of just, you know, going a little bit more train of thought, or just kind of going into a zone of just staying on the topic. Like, you know, whatever that topic is, I'm good at, if you give me the topic, the song is going to be about this. I can give you, you know, two verses, 24 bars each about that topic. But musical, it doesn't work that way. The musical, you make it clear at the beginning what the topic is, and then the rest of the song has to be pushing the action forward. And that's been the challenge.
Have you ever had a concept in mind and thinking, okay, this would make a great album, and you may have abandoned it and says, nah, or, you know, you've changed route. Are there any kind of concept albums on the cutting room floor that you'd be willing to share with us today?
Yeah, there was one. I had an album concept. The album was going to be called The Rules of Engagement, and it was going to be a story about a friend who had just recently gotten engaged to a girl who wasn't right for him. And the whole story was going to be him going through this. There was a movie, in the early 2000s called Saving Silverman. I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
I heard of it.
It was a group of, it was a couple of friends, and their buddy was getting engaged, and the buddies hated the girl. The girl was like super, you know, aggressive, and she was in charge, and they were trying to do everything they could to stop him from getting married to this girl. And so it was kind of like loosely based on that movie concept. But it was just going to be, you know, like the album was going to start with my friend telling me he just got engaged, and me explaining how this was a bad idea to the audience. And then it never materialized, but it definitely was always in the back of my mind.
Okay. All right. And I heard another rumor, actually. It was really interesting to me. Crooklyn was going to be a full length album and a group at one point. There was discussions about it.
Yeah. Spike Lee wanted to do it with me, Special Ed, and Buckshot. And he had an album deal or some sort of a distribution deal with MCA Records, and they were going to do it. They were going to push forward and put it out and promote it. And then everything kind of, that whole idea went by the wayside when Buckshot wasn't available to do Crooklyn 2, because the three of us were supposed to also do Crooklyn 2. And so once it was clear that Buckshot wasn't going to be on Crooklyn 2, you know, me and Special Ed were trying to find another rapper to be on the song. And then at that point, Spike Lee was like, nah, let's just do three new artists, three new cats. And that was the end of the whole album project, right then and there.
Oh man, it's one of those, I think it's going to go down as one of the biggest what ifs in hip hop history, I think, because that would have been crazy, especially then, because the timing for you with Crooklyn, I know that there were some whispers and maybe some criticism about your sound at that particular time and the regional sounds you were playing with.
Yeah.
Talk about the timing of Crooklyn and what that did in terms of maybe, you know, getting people back on your side.
It was the timing was actually perfect for me because I had my song Born to Roll was really, really blowing up in other markets, West Coast, Midwest, Southwest. It was getting a lot of radio play every place but New York. And when you saw the video, it was clear that the video was shot in Los Angeles. The images, the cars, the women, you could tell that it was definitely not New York. And so, you know, this was a time in hip hop where, you know, this whole East West rivalry was really, really brewing, you know, quite feverishly. And I found myself trying to sort of walk the tightrope between East and West and trying to bridge the gap with what I was trying to do, but it just was not working. And so to ask to be on a song, you know, about the city that I was from was just the perfect timing because it got me a chance to remind people where I was from. Because many people, to be honest, many people on the West Coast didn't, when they heard Born to Roll, they had never heard of me before that. And so they assumed the sound and the video and the way I was dressed, they assumed I was from LA. And so a lot of that was confusing to people. So for me to be on Crooklyn was a great way to remind people of my roots, where I was from, where I made my start. And I'm glad that Q-Tip made the call and asked me to be one of the artists.
No doubt. Let's stick with Sitting on Chrome though. One of my favorite duos is the Cellar Dwellers. I hate to be one of those people that, you know, people don't talk about them enough, but I feel they're very underrated in many ways. How did you hook up with the Cellar Dwellers in the first place? Because I first heard them on For the Mind and I was like, yo, these guys are dope.
Yeah. They were friends with Digger. He's the one who brought them around the studio and stuff. And, you know, I heard them rap and I thought, these guys are dope. They're different. You know, I'd heard them on probably Stretching Barbido or something like that, but I think he was the first person that brought them around into the studio. And so I saw the talent, I saw, and they had young energy. You know, I'd been in the game a while and they felt like the new guard. They felt like the next movement of artists. They were kind of more cut from the, you know, maybe the, you know, Wu-Tang, Mobb Deep, like that next generation of artists. They were cut from that cloth. So I felt like this was a good chance for me to put some new blood that was up and coming on my project. And so, yeah, I asked them to be on for the Mind and they did their thing with it.
I was watching your Disposable Arts documentary. Disposable Arts is one of my favorites. Like, man, like that album, we'll get into it. Oh, it's crazy. One thing that was really interesting to me though, because I'm a liner notes guy, and you talk about 78, 88, the studio. And, you know, in terms of studios, like I know D&D, I know Chunking, Powerplay, but that was new for me. Can you describe the vibe of that studio and what made it special in terms of this being the place you wanted to record the album?
Well, 78, 88, a lot of people don't know, but it was a studio before it was 78, 88. And in that studio was where Herbie Lovebug did a lot of his recording. He recorded a lot of Kid and Play stuff, Salt and Pepper, Kwame, a few other people as well. But when I first came there, it was because they were working on a compilation and they were trying to get different artists to come in and record songs in, and they were bartering studio time. So it was like, do a song for the album and we'll give you 10 hours of studio time. So I was like, oh, this is a cool deal. You know, no cash, but I can work on records. And so I went there and did the barter system with them. And that's how the song with me and Buckshot called Brooklyn Blocks and the B-side was a song called Last Breath. Those songs were made in that bartering of studio time for my feature on their, because they had a compilation called Game Over, Volume 1, and then Volume 2. So that's what they were doing. And when I came there, there was three different control rooms, but never once did I come there and not see notable artists either hanging in the lobby, smoking, or recording in different rooms. There was always a who's who of artists coming through there. The list is endless of the amount of people that have come there and recorded there. And I just thought it was a cool vibe. Filthy Rich was him and DJ Rob were the partners in the company, and they were the ones who were putting this album out. And so I got to know them. They got to know me. And they were the ones who really said, yo, you know, we think you got another album in you. And I was already kind of like done. In my mind, I was done. It was, you know, I didn't think that there was any interest in me doing another record, but they were the ones who put the idea. They planted the seed in my head. I was dismissive. Like, nah, I'm good. I'm good. I'm not doing another record. But they planted that seed. And then that same year I went on tour in Europe, a bunch of dates in the UK and a few in Germany. And, it was that tour in 2000. That was 2000. It was that tour that kind of gave me that newfound energy to, when I got back from that tour, I said, yo, I think I do want to do another record. Yeah. I've been talking about it. I think I'm ready to do it. And I want to go out on my own terms. And the result of that was Disposable Us.
Which was is a classic album. That was actually the first Master Ace album I bought with my own money. Okay. You know, this was like, I have a second act in terms of hip hop. So when I got my first computer, like in 2003, mm-hmm. I got into like Little Brother and all that stuff. Wow. Fell down this rabbit hole. Then I just found, oh, Disposable Arts, Master Ace is still doing bits. So, you know, it's my favorite album by you. And I definitely hold it in high regard.
Thank you. It's my favorite album of mine too.
Dope. I know it came out October 2001, and we're coming up to the 20th anniversary.
Crazy, right?
Of the 9/11 attacks and your album. How did the events of 9/11 impact the promotion of that particular album?
It impacted it greatly. The first wave of what was going to be the promotion of that album was in the form of a tour, a European tour. And we had planned this tour during the summer of 2001. All the dates were laid out. I think there was 24 dates in 30 days or something like that. It was a very packed schedule. There were probably, of those 24, probably eight or 10 might have been in the UK. And when the attacks on September happened, it threw everything in disarray because everybody was canceling their tours. Our flights were already purchased and bought, were leaving on September 22nd. So 11 days after the planes hit the building was when our flights were scheduled to leave. We weren't even sure if there were going to be flights. And the interesting thing is we had just come home from another trip. I had just come home from another trip and my luggage was lost. And so my luggage got lost. It was at Kennedy Airport. And then the attack happened on the 11th. And then I didn't get my bag. The lost luggage didn't get returned to me until probably the 18th or the 19th. I mean, there wasn't anything that was going to stop me from going on the next tour, but that's one of my bags that I travel with, my tour bag. So it was just a really uncertain time. You know, the tour was featuring Punchin' Words as well as Strickland, DJ AV, DJ JF. And Wordsworth's wife at the time, she was his girlfriend at the time, she was pregnant with their first daughter. And when we left, she was like, I want to say 3 months. No, she was more than that. She was like 6 months pregnant. And he was really thinking about not going. And, you know, it took a pretty long phone conversation. I don't even know if I really felt right convincing him to go on the tour, just because I wasn't so certain myself. I just knew that this was an opportunity for us. I didn't know what the opportunity meant, but I knew that if we didn't go on this tour, that there was going to be no real promotion for this record. So, you know, and we had promoted them being on the tour, and they were part of my show. You know, they had two songs on the album. Everything was already planned out, the way they were going to come out on stage, perform with me. And so it would have required me to really revamp my entire show. It wouldn't have been as dope of a tour. I eventually convinced Wordsworth, and he spoke to his girl at the time, and he agreed to go on the tour. And that tour was the catalyst to everything that's been happening for the last 20 years, as far as me traveling to Europe and being on stage. Because every other artist at that time canceled their tours. Every other tour was canceled. We were like pretty much the only U.S. act that came over at that time. And all the shows were packed, very well attended. People were just happy that in such a difficult time and everything going on in the world, that there was a show to go to. And we wound up really endearing ourselves to a huge audience of people over in Europe, Germany, UK, Switzerland, Sweden, Netherlands. We endeared ourselves to a lot of people, and those people are now in their 30s and 40s, no, 30s for sure, probably some in the early 40s that came to that tour back then, and they still remember those, you know, that tour, and they talk about it to this day.
I have to say though, you are probably one of the dopest live performers I've ever seen, if we're talking about tours.
Thank you.
A&E at the Jazz Cafe, you man smashed it, like, and you did you did some of the Slaughterhouse stuff. You even did Wishing. That's my favorite song with you and Edo.
Yeah.
I have to give you guys props. You guys are sick.
Thank you, man. Thank you. I learned from the best. That's what I always say. You know, my two label mates, Big Daddy Kane and Biz Markie, were in those days probably two of the best live acts that you could see. And because they were my label mates, I got to see them pretty often. And so I was a student. I was watching. I watched the crowd interaction. I watched the DJ switch the records. I watched the little nuance, you know, things that Biz or Kane would say to the DJ, the stuff that the crowd would never even notice. He would, you know, tell them something, and then all of a sudden they would switch to this, or this record would come in. So I paid attention to all that stuff, and I learned how to perform from watching those two artists right there.
Yeah, it shows. I know part of the impetus in terms of the disposable arts concept stemmed from your time on Big Beat. What happened over there? And do you think we'll ever get a chance to hear that album you produced for Big Beat the way you intended for it to be heard?
Nah, you'll never hear that album. Some of the songs I released through Shelf Life. It's a couple of different Shelf Life was one of the projects, and then there was one called Lost Tapes. So a couple of the songs found their way out in the marketplace, but there's a few records that, to be honest with you, I wasn't really that proud of, because they, you know, what happened at Big Beat was Bad Boy happened. Bad Boy happened, Junior Mafia happened. And when Bad Boy kind of took over the music game at that time, every label was looking for those kinds of records. You know, that was their sound. They were the ones that were kind of doing the R&B flips and turning them into rap joints, party records, club bangers or whatever. That was what they were doing. And the label wanted this. They wanted everybody to, all the labels wanted everybody to follow suit and make these kind of records. And it wasn't where my heart was or what I wanted to do creatively. But I understood that if I was going to keep this record deal, that I probably needed to at least make an attempt to give them some of what they were asking for. So I went in the studio and made some records that I don't think would have ever been made, you know, with the shakers and the little funky shakers and all that I probably would have never done, trying to make the label happy. And I went as far as I could go creatively with giving them what they wanted, and it still wasn't enough. You know, they were like, well, let's get Changing Faces, or let's get, you know, let's get Brian McKnight to sing a hook. You know, that those were the kind of suggestions that were coming at me. And I was like, man, I'm not going to be able to, we're not on the same page at all. So let's just, you know, figure something else out. It was actually them who decided to shelf the album after I came back to them with new music, and it still wasn't what they were asking for. It was their decision to let me go and to shelve me. And that kind of created the bitterness. That was probably 98, 99, right in there. And that's where the title Disposable Arts kind of comes from, because they showed me that it was no big deal for them to just shelf my record, shelf my music, all stuff I've been working on for 2 years, to just shelve it and move on and sign somebody else.
It's funny you mention Bad Boy happened. I spoke to Grap Lover a few months ago, and we were talking about why the I and I album got shelved. And he said the same thing when he was over at Elektra. They were like, we need you to do stuff like what Bad Boy and Puffy's doing. And it just made me wonder, just like, you know, how much music or good music we could have missed out on just because this person's doing this and doing it so well that you're expected to follow. You know, it's quite interesting.
It's quite
interesting. I know you did some work with A Touch of Jazz in the early 2000s. You found yourself in Philly. Any memories from that session, and how did you end up over there?
How did I end up over there? DJ AV was my DJ at the time. Or no, actually, he wasn't even my DJ yet. He became my DJ in 2001. But he was really good friends with Jazzy Jeff. And I heard that they were working on music. And I think Jeff invited me just to come out one day and just to kind of sit in on a session. I believe they were working on Will Smith's album. And they asked me to come out to maybe work on writing a couple of joints. And so I came out for a session and I saw what was going on. And I was like, this is dope. They had all these rooms going and there was producers in every room working on stuff, instruments and singers and drum machines. And like every room you went in, somebody was in there working hard on something. And it all sounded dope to me. And it just gave me a renewed excitement about hip hop. Cause at that point I wasn't even really trying to do music. I was cool with just being a writer. I was cool with just being a producer. I wasn't even going to do more records, but being in that atmosphere and that environment, that gave me a boost. That made me feel like, wow, you can actually still kind of do your own thing and it'd be dope and people want it. And being around those guys was crucial, because, you know, it helped me to find my creative voice again.
Moving on. I know I said you play well with others earlier. I got to say, EMC the Show is, I keep coming back to that album, Ace. I keep finding and hearing new things, and it just amazes me that you're able to take three people, different styles, and you know, I assume they've got different personalities, bring them into this world and make it work. Like, how do you go about writing a concept album for a group with all the different characters involved?
Well, it helps when the people involved are willing to kind of let you drive the car. You know, nobody was trying to fight me for the steering wheel and, yo, I think we should do this instead. You know, that idea is dope, but let's try this. They trusted me. And part of it probably was because they were on my two previous solo albums, you know, Disposable and Long Hot Summer. And they saw how those turned out. So shout out to those guys for trusting me to drive the car. And they let me kind of create the narrative for what the storyline was going to be on the album. And they just trusted me. That's the bottom line. Nobody tried to, you know, overrule or bring it to a vote. Like, none of that stuff happened. They just trusted that I was going to deliver something dope, and they were just happy to be a part of it.
I hear you. Are we going to get a new EMC album with the original lineup?
The original four MCs?
Yeah.
Probably won't happen. probably won't happen because the relationship is not really mended there. You know, with me, I don't like to really go backwards. Even if me and whoever I'm not, you know, cordial with anymore, even if things are smoothed out and it's all love again, I'm still not trying to go back to being creative with the person anymore. And that's why, you know, you won't see me working with, you know, the Lord Diggers and the Paula Perrys and people like that, just because it's water under the bridge for me. I've moved on, wished them well, and that's what it is. I truly believe that from the very beginning, the very first EMC album, The Show, that there was always kind of a little bit of a disconnect. Because Punch was always kind of the outlier in everything that we were trying to do. And he always found himself not quite a part of everything that we were doing, you know, from the very first video, from the What It Stand For video. You wouldn't know it, but you know, the group, all the group shots, when there's four of us, he's not actually in those shots. We got a rapper, Jay Zone, actually came and put on an EMC jacket and turned his back, so we could at least have the image of four MCs. But Punch wasn't even in town for the video. He was supposed to come into town.
That's crazy.
Yeah, go back and look at it. You'll see the fourth person's back is turned the whole time.
And that's Jay Zone.
That's Jay Zone. filling standing in, because he was the right complexion, so it worked out. But yeah, that kind of stuff was happening from the very beginning of the project. And so that's how I kind of knew. That's how I kind of knew like something's not quite right. And it's wild because I look back at the cover, like after when things went left with us and Punch was no longer in the group, I look back at the album cover. And if you look at the album cover, it's very interesting. There's a sign. The sign has an arrow, and the arrow is pointing down to Punch. And right next to the arrow, there's a number 3 in a box. And I was like, yo, this was an omen from the very beginning. I mean, of course, you're just looking at it and creating your own narrative. But to me, it was like, this was an omen. Like, the arrow is pointing to him as the outlier. And then there's a box with the number 3, basically saying there should be 3 of us, not 4 of us. And that's just what I created in my... Go back and look at the cover, though. It's pretty interesting.
No, I can see it in my head. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
You know, but with all that said, you know, EMC, really, really special group to me. I remember when that album actually leaked. And I was like, oh, wow, like, you know, it's not just me looking forward to this. I think the show, I'm not going to say it's a classic. I'd say it's a personal classic for me, because I go back and I listen to it. Like, Leak It Out... We All Right, you know. You should have put 4 Brothers on the album, though.
Yeah, you're right. It was a fun time. That was a fun time making that record. We had a great time making it. The touring, the shows with the 4 of us was always so much energy, so much positive energy, and running around on stage, 4 of us was always a lot of fun and a good time. It's good memories from that time. I don't have any bad memories of that time period of us touring together.
That's good. Marco Polo, A Brooklyn Story. It's been, what, 3 years? Wow. 3 years since the album came out. It was interesting. You know, you did a song with Premier and dropped it after the album came out. Was that recorded as part of the album sessions, or why did it come out after?
Because Premier worked too slow. That's the bottom line.
I've heard that.
It was supposed to be on the album, but he was just moving so slow. I was like, Marco, we can't push this album back no more. Like, let's just put the album out and use it as a bonus record. And that's what we had to do.
But, you know, it was good to hear, because I know, and you probably, people have told you that we wanted to hear Ace and Premier for years.
Me too. That was the one guy that I felt like, because we had been friends way before all these records, all these Gangstar records and all that. I knew Premier before No, well, I met him right around the time that they were recording No More Mr. Nice Guy. So
it's a long time.
That's when I met him. Guru introduced us, and I actually wound up being even cooler with Premier than I was with Guru, hanging out with Premier more. But he did the scratches on my song Saturday Night Live. And so it was just crazy that for as long as we had known each other, I had never rapped over one of his beats. And so I was just happy that we finally got to that point of being able to do it.
Yeah. There's another producer I want to hear you work with. And I know you sent a subtle shot at him on Acknowledge, and that's Knots.
Yeah. Knots
is
dope, though.
I really think I'd love to, I mean, the fan in me, I just want to hear Ace and Knots. I'll see if we can make that happen.
Did I rap over a Knots joint?
I was thinking, and I couldn't find any.
I feel like somebody featured me on something and Knots did the beat, but don't quote me. I do a lot of features, so I
know.
I get lost in the sauce sometimes. Something made me feel like I did a verse for somebody, and it ended up being that Knots did the beat, but I can't think of what it is right now.
Yeah, I'll do some digging.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When are we going to get the new MP Master Ace album, Master Polo? When can we expect it? I know you said in previous interviews you've done about 2 or 3 songs and you've picked about 20 beats. Please update us.
We're at the same spot. I got a bunch of beats, sitting there, great beats. I'm just, you know, 2020 kind of took all my energy because of the way the year went, and because of the pandemic, the election, politics, everything that was happening. It just wore me out, and it sapped my creative energy to a certain extent. So I said, you know, I don't want to write an album in this environment. I would rather write the album after things get feel more positive. Because I felt like the album was going to be super dark, super negative, super political. And I didn't want to do a record like that. I just didn't want to. So I said, I need to wait until, you know, some of this has passed and I feel a little bit more optimistic about the future before I start to write the record. And so Marco understood that. He was very patient with me, and he let me kind of do it in my own time. And he continuously keeps sending me new beats. So I'm definitely right around 20 or more. And it's just up to us to kind of pick the final, you know, ones that are going to make the album. But the music that I have right now is plenty, like it's enough. And, yeah, I've written to 2, 3, and I'm just waiting because something usually happens with me where my body tells me, okay, it's time. And
at 4 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of the night?
Yeah, that's when it happens sometimes. And I just get that inspiration. I go, now I know where I want to go with this. So I'm just kind of waiting for that moment. But the beats are there. Mark was being really patient. I think us getting back on the road will, which we're going back out together to Europe in October. I think that'll help push it forward, because being around him and being around the touring life and back into the mix of what we used to do, that'll make my mind feel more normal and back to a place of, okay, creativity again. Because all my creative energy has been going to this musical right now. But I think being out on the road will give me a good reset. And on tour is where I get a chance to really listen to beats while I'm in the room, in my hotel room by myself. You know, if I'm packing, let's say we got to leave at 11 o'clock and I got to pack all my stuff up. I'm in the room packing. I got the beat going. And that's when all the rhymes start coming to me. I'm like, ooh, I know what I want to say for this. Boom, boom, boom. The song's going to be about this. So I think it'll be a good reset.
I'm looking forward to it. And to close, let's end it like Disposable Arts. I've got a question. 2021, 20 years since Disposable Arts. Do you still have no regrets?
No major ones. Definitely not about the rap career, but one of the regrets probably I had is that when I was getting all the airplay and notoriety in Los Angeles and other markets outside of New York, I didn't really embrace that notoriety. I ran from it. I ran from it because I was like, yo, I'm from Brooklyn, man. I don't want people thinking I'm from LA. And so I kind of missed the boat a little bit on what could have been a very promising career as a producer, because all of those records that were getting all the airplay, Born to Roll, Sitting on Chrome, INC Rod, I produced all those records. And I certainly could have taken, you know, the fumes from the success of those records and produced for a lot of other people and really probably made a career as a producer in this game. But I was just so intent on getting back to New York and getting New York back on my side. That's what I spent all my time worrying about. And it never really panned out that way. I should have just focused on where my bread was buttered at that time. And my bread was buttered in LA and on the West Coast and on the Southwest and the Midwest. And I could have done a lot more to make records with other people. So I'll never know what that could have been like, because that could have been a whole different type of career.
I hear you. Master Ace, just want to say thank you so much. And from me as a hip-hop fan of, it's coming up to like 30 years. I wrote my first rhyme when I was 9. I'm 39 years old. You are one of the people I look to in this culture. You are reliable. You're consistent. Anytime I see a Master Ace project, I can buy it with confidence, knowing that you're going to deliver some art, and you are a resident in my top 10 MCs.
Thank you, man. That means a lot, man.
You've been there since 01, and you've remained there. And I've got a something on the wish list. If I had the money and the access, my dream is to do a concept album, executive produced by yourself and Prince Paul.
That'd be cool.
That would be crazy. You write the narrative, Prince Paul does the production, because he's another master of the concept album.
He is.
But no, you're special, you know, on behalf of myself and Summit, you know, thank you so much. And looking forward to seeing you in the UK real soon.
Absolutely, man. We'll be there soon.
Respect to Master Ace for pulling up to the show. And like I said, we've wanted to speak to him for a long time. And as a fan, he definitely did not disappoint. I want to send a special shout out to one of our new listeners. He goes by the name of Desmond Powell. He discovered the pod from our Reasonable Doubt series, and he's been tuned in ever since. He's been on the socials, he's been sharing, he's been sending messages, and he says he's really enjoying the show. And I just want to say thank you to Desmond. We really appreciate you for tuning in. Desmond is just one of the many new listeners who are much younger and use this pod as a resource tool. So with that said, if you're intrigued by Master Ace and you want to learn more about his story, check out his discography. I personally think that his best solo album is Disposable Arts. Summit loves A Long Hot Summer, but don't sleep on the Slaughterhouse albums and Sitting on Chrome either. You can buy all these albums, merch, and even a bottle of CMOS at Ace's official website, which is www.masterace.com. As always, we are on the socials. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Break the Atoms. You can find me at I Am Kinetic with a K at the end. And you can find Summit at Hip Hop Chronicle. We'll be back next week with more hip hop culture related goodness. And until then, peace.